Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, the Vatican issues a new document responding to questions about doctrine on the Church. We speak to the Undersecretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And 1 year after an Israeli Hezbollah war brought Lebanon to its knees, how is the country faring? We talked to one Catholic aid agency about the ongoing repercussions and new threats to stability in Lebanon. The Vatican has issued a new question and answer style document to help Catholics and non-Catholics understand how the Church perceives its mission and identity. The 16-page document entitled Responses to Some Questions Regarding Certain Aspects of the Doctrine on the Church was prepared by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. In the introduction to the booklet, the Vatican Office explains it is fruit of a continuous theological reflection on a number of other Church documents, among them the Second Vatican Council's dogmatic constitution, Lumen Gentium, and its decrees on ecumenism and the Oriental Churches. The document also seeks to further clarify the theological underpinnings of encyclical letters by Popes Paul VI and John Paul II, and declarations such as Dominus Iesus issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. While Prefect of the Congregation, Cardinal William Levada, and Archbishop Angelo Amato, Secretary of the same office, answer 5 questions concerning doctrine on the Church and provide footnotes to support their responses. Here they are. Did the Second Vatican Council change the Catholic doctrine on the Church?
The Second Vatican Council neither changed nor intended to change this doctrine. Rather, it developed, deepened, and more fully explained it. This was exactly what John XXIII said at the beginning of the Council. Paul VI affirmed it and commented in the act of promulgating the Constitution Lumen Gentium. There is no better comment to make than to say that this promulgation really changes nothing of the traditional doctrine. What Christ willed, we also will. What was, still is. What the Church has taught down through the centuries, we also teach. In simple terms, that which was assumed is now explicit. That which was uncertain is now clarified. That which was meditated upon, discussed, and sometimes argued over is now put together in one clear formulation. The bishops repeatedly expressed and fulfilled this intention.
What is the meaning of the affirmation that the Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church?
Christ established here on earth only one church and instituted it as a visible and spiritual community that from its beginning and throughout the centuries has always existed and will always exist, and in which alone are found all the elements that Christ himself instituted. This one Church of Christ, which we confess in the Creed as one holy, Catholic, and apostolic, this Church, constituted and organized in this world as a society, subsists in the Catholic Church, governed by the successor of Peter and the bishops in communion with him. In number 8 of the dogmatic constitution Lumen Gentium, subsistence means this perduring historical continuity and the permanence of all the elements instituted by Christ in the Catholic Church, in which the Church of Christ is concretely found on this earth. It is possible, according to Catholic doctrine, to affirm correctly that the Church of Christ is present and operative in the churches and ecclesial communities not yet fully in communion with the Catholic Church, on account of the elements of sanctification and truth that are present in them. Nevertheless, the word subsists can only be attributed to the Catholic Church alone precisely because it refers to the mark of unity that we profess in the symbols of the faith. I believe in the one church, and this one church subsists in the Catholic Church.
Why was the expression subsists in adopted instead of the simple word is?
The use of this expression, which indicates the full identity of the Church of Christ with the Catholic Church, does not change the doctrine on the Church. Rather, it comes from and brings out more clearly the fact that there are numerous elements of sanctification and of truth which are found outside her structure, but which, as gifts properly belonging to the Church of Christ, impel towards Catholic unity. It follows that these separated churches and communities, though we believe they suffer from defects, are deprived neither of significance nor importance in the mystery of salvation. In fact, the Spirit of Christ has not refrained from using them as instruments of salvation, whose value derives from that fullness of grace and of truth which has been entrusted to the Catholic Church.
Why does the Second Vatican Council use the term church in reference to the Oriental churches, separated from full communion with the Catholic Church?
The Council wanted to adopt the traditional use of the term. Because these churches, although separated, have true sacraments, and above all, because of the apostolic succession, the priesthood, and the Eucharist, by means of which they remain linked to us by very close bonds, they merit the title of particular or local churches and are called sister churches of the particular Catholic churches. It is through the celebration of the Eucharist of the Lord in each of these churches that the Church of God is built up and grows in stature. However, since communion with the Catholic Church, the visible head of which is the Bishop of Rome and the successor of Peter, is not some external complement to a particular church, but rather one of its internal constitutive principles, these venerable Christian communities lack something in their condition as particular churches. On the other hand, because of the division between Christians, the fullness of universality which is proper to the church governed by the successor of Peter and the bishops in communion with him is not fully realized in history.
Why do the texts of the Council and those of the Magisterium since the Council not use the title church with regard to those Christian communities born out of the Reformation of the 16th century?
According to Catholic doctrine, these communities do not enjoy apostolic succession in the sacrament of orders, and are therefore deprived of a constitutive element of the Church. These ecclesial communities, which, specifically because of the absence of the sacramental priesthood, have not preserved the genuine and integral substance of the Eucharistic mystery, cannot, according to Catholic doctrine, be called churches in the proper sense.
The new document was signed by Pope Benedict XVI on the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, celebrated on June 29th. Well, Charles Collins sat down with the Undersecretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Father Augustine de Noia, for further clarification on the new document. He began by asking him to outline the major points that it addresses.
There really are two main points, and then some, let's say, minor points. The main point is to address the question of whether the Second Vatican Council changed the Church's teaching on the nature of the Church herself. And this document tries to clarify this point to say, no, it was a development, a deepening, but definitely not a kind of change in the sense of altering the way in which we think of the Church. And the point is, the fundamental point, and this is the second thing, is how to interpret the expression of the Second Vatican Council, Lumen Gentium, paragraph 8, quote, "The Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church." And it's this subsists that has caused a tremendous amount of questioning, and we're trying to address this. And briefly, the point is that instead of saying that the Church of Christ is the Catholic Church, the subsists is used to say that the same thing, but in order to make it clear that across the whole of history and in the present, we are not in a state of having an imperfect church that has yet to become the Church of Christ, but that the fullness of what Christ wanted the church to be, he has established in the Catholic Church. And then, of course, the other points, in order to explain how other churches and ecclesial communities relate to this. The Vatican Council did not want to exclude the possibility that there were, in fact, elements of ecclesial life, valid sacraments or the means of grace. I mean, all of the church ecclesial communities that read the scriptures in that sense with faith have a certain element of what Christ intended the church to be.
Why was it decided to have this document come out at this time?
That's an important question, and I suppose it has to do with the reaction to an earlier document, that the famous Dominus Iesus, that came out, if you recall, in 2000. I remember that when I was working for the Bishops' Conference in the United States, and we had received advance copies of this document, and I was asked to prepare the bishops for Dominus Iesus, I said, well, there's absolutely nothing new here, so the bishops will be fine with it. But as you know, the reaction to Dominus Iesus was extremely, let's say, contestative. I mean, it was a very difficult document. And what we saw was that people simply didn't understand that not simply that we had to speak of Christ as being the universal Savior, but that the church was the principal means by which the grace of Christ would be communicated to the world. And that, if you recall, created most of the controversy, certainly ecumenically. So this was a kind of wake-up call. I'd say Dominus Iesus was a wake-up call, that 30 years after Vatican II, people seemed to have forgotten something very essential that Vatican II taught. And so it was out of that moment that the cardinal members of the congregation, and also other people, bishops and so on, raising questions about this, the congregation decided to proceed with a clarification. The document is called Responses to Questions Regarding Certain Aspects of the Doctrine of the Church. It's a very narrow point. It's a relatively short document, as you know, with a commentary attached. So it's a very precise set of responses to questions that have arisen.
Now, you've already mentioned Lumen Gentium and Dominus Iesus. How does this new document relate to previous documents speaking about the nature of the Church and ecumenism that have been released?
The responses, because there are a couple, do not add anything to the preceding teaching of the Magisterium, but really are meant to recall and make more precise the authentic significance of the various doctrinal expressions used to speak about the Church in past Magisterium. You see, it's a very important point that experientially, that when you go into a Catholic church, essentially this document is reaffirming this point, this very fundamental point, that when you go into a Catholic church and become, let's say, a participant in the community there with the round of Mass and sacrament of penance and baptism and confirmation and everything else that goes on there, you will find everything that Christ intended the church to be. And even though there are divisions in Christianity, that does not mean that the church does not exist perfectly. You see, it's not that we have to repair or heal the divisions. We do have to seek the unity among all of the Christian communities that Christ willed. But the fact that not all churches are in communion with the See of Peter does not mean that the church is wounded to the effect that it no longer exists in its integrity.
And finally, of course, this document is about the Catholic Church and also strongly touches on how the other churches and ecclesial communions relate to the Catholic Church. Can you tell us how this document can be used to help in ecumenical dialogue?
The commitment of the Catholic Church to ecumenical dialogue is, as Pope Benedict XVI himself has said, and certainly Pope John Paul II said frequently as well, irrenunciable. That is to say, the Church is not backtracking on its ecumenical commitment. But as you know, it is fundamental to any kind of dialogue that the participants are clear about their own identity. That is, dialogue cannot be an occasion to accommodate or soften what you actually understand yourself to be in order to achieve a sort of false sense of consensus. It is a fundamental condition of dialogue, really, that the participants are clear about what their self-identity is, so that, in a sense, they're being truthful. I mean, they're coming to the table with and a clear expression of what they understand themselves to be. So it's, in that sense, it is never a backtracking from dialogue to be clear about what you are, but it's an essential condition for it. Otherwise, the results that you achieve, they're easily undermined by the truth about it.
Father Augustine de Noia is the Undersecretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He was speaking there to my colleague, Charles Collins. It was a year ago this week that war erupted between Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon, a war that lasted only 34 days, but whose impact is still reverberating heavily in both countries. The conflict was triggered by Hezbollah's capture of two Israeli soldiers in a cross-border raid on July 12th. By the time the two sides laid down their arms just over a month later, Lebanon had nearly 1,200 dead and over 4,000 wounded. Israel lost 158 lives and suffered nearly 2,000 wounded. While heavy Israeli bombing caused massive damage to much of Lebanon's infrastructure. So, 1 year after this short but deadly conflict, how is the recovery effort progressing in Lebanon? And how do the people there feel about their future? Susie Hodges has been finding out.
During the war, Israeli bombing devastated many areas of southern Lebanon and Beirut's Shiite suburbs, along with bridges, ports, factories, power networks, and other targets elsewhere. Almost a million Lebanese fled their homes in the conflict zone. And the government says 125,000 homes were destroyed or damaged. Another lingering consequence of the conflict is the contamination of many areas in the south by Israeli cluster bombs. The United Nations estimated that 1 million cluster bomblets were dropped by the Israelis, with perhaps 40% of them failing to explode on impact. George Houri is director of Caritas Lebanon, and he told me more about the continuing difficulties faced by the population in southern Lebanon.
Most of the population returned and are settling back in their hometowns, but they still suffer from shortage of everything, you know. The economical situation is very bad, and there is no way to earn decently a living in the villages on the borderline. Still, there is, you know, a very big tension. There is a real threat, as you probably have heard of what happened to the Spanish battalion from the UNIFIL. They lost 6 of their troops, and we still are under the threat of bomb attacks and mining.
Do people there think another war could break out of the same type? Because that war was very inconclusive, and nobody, you know, Israel didn't manage to achieve what it hoped to achieve, for instance.
Your analysis to the situation reflects the reality in our country. We are still, you know, fearing a start again of the war activities and hostilities from both sides, the militias, who are very sophisticatedly and highly armed. And on the other, you have the Israelis who still have some plans to implement with regard to have peaceful border with Lebanon. On both sides, there is a large military activities.
And what about the problem of cluster bombs? This was a major problem in the aftermath of the war, with millions being dropped by Israel. Have they now been cleared?
Not totally. They are working. The UNIFIL, the United Nations troops, are working on clearing the fields. But, you know, most of what they have been able to do is clear it out from the villages and in between the houses and homes. But most of the population in the south are working with agriculture, and they have a great fear they cannot go to their field to harvest or work their land. So they are, by that way, out of resources, you know. They cannot earn decently their living.
Is Caritas helping in any way these people?
You know, very little help comes to these people, and they have large needs. No matter how much and what we give, it leaves them with a lot of needs to cover. Since they are not producing anything, they have no funds to pay the school tuition. They have no money to pay their hospital or medical care, even medicines. So it's getting very hard.
And so how would you describe the mood or the morale of these people?
It's a very shaking morale they have. They go by ups and downs, but there is nothing sure for the future.
The inconclusive war between Israel and Hezbollah guerrillas didn't just cause death and destruction and economic hardship, as we just heard. Analysts say the conflict has had a significant political impact by increasing divisions between rival groups throughout Lebanon as a whole. Assassins have killed 2 anti-Syrian politicians in the past 8 months, and more than 200 people have died in battles between Lebanese troops and Al-Qaeda-inspired militants in a Palestinian refugee camp. In the south, a car bomber killed 6 UN peacekeepers last month. The various factions are all reported to be rearming, despite denials, and the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict is far from resolved. Given the current tensions and political deadlock at the government level, it's little wonder that many Lebanese are increasingly concerned about their country's future. Houri says although the war between Israel and the Hezbollah guerrillas ended last August, he believes conflict is still stalking his country.
War is going on and still going on in our country. It's taking different aspects, you know, and it's covering different areas, but it's the real and same trauma on all the population in Lebanon, and in particular the Christian groups among all the population. Fortunately, the Arab states are supporting militarily, financially, morally, politically, and all kinds of support comes to the Muslims in our country, while the Christians are getting very, very little support from the West, with whom we share some ideals for democracy, for freedom, for dignity, for independence, the Arab world suffer from the military fundamentalism, where war and killing people and bloodshed, and we also have all the money which comes from the petrodollar and is, you know, dominating all aspects in our life. We are very uncertain about our future, and especially when it comes to the Christians. We are going through a lot of pressures. The Muslims and fundamentalism, they have large amounts of money which they use in different ways and by different means to dominate as much as they can and to have Lebanon become a Muslim world.
Is there a lot of immigration because of this ongoing tension and, as you say, the violence that ever so often...
Unemployment on one hand and shortage of opportunities for jobs. And on the other hand, you have this uncertain future and the threat of the Islamism and fundamentalism makes that most of the Christians emigrate. We have since last year, July last year, until now, we have lost some 400 young Christians who have gone abroad, either to Europe or United Arab Emirates or to Australia and United States.
And is this an exodus that is continuing?
Yes, the exodus is still going on. You have to come and see how people are queuing in the embassies for visas. And they are accepting any offer they can get.
And do many Lebanese, whatever their religion, whatever their ethnic group, fear that there could be another civil war like, say, what there was in the 1980s?
We hope not. I don't think that a civil war have too much success. But we still not know if one group gets strong enough to go on, to embark into a civil war or not. It's a real threat.
But how free is Lebanon as a society?
We cannot say that Lebanon is totally free. The two major groups who are, you know, for the time being against each other, one group gets the support of the East and the other group gets the support of the West.
And you feel caught in the middle somehow?
Yeah. Try to catch the attention of the Westerns about the freedom and the integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon. We want them to pledge for, you know.
And you feel this freedom and the integrity of Lebanon is definitely under threat at the moment?
Yes.
That was George Khoury, Director of Caritas Lebanon, and I'm Susie Hodges.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.